My guest is Javier Espinoza. Javier Espinoza covers competition and digital policy at the Financial Times Brussels Bureau. Welcome to the podcast, Javier.
Thank you very much, Paul. I cannot say how honored I am to be your guest.
Well, you're part of a long line of FT journalists I've interviewed over the years. So welcome to that very elite club, as you say. Right, we're going to talk about how the EU, how Brussels, they say, regulates the tech industry, starting with the European Commission, but and then how the lobbies gear into action. We'll start maybe on the legislative slide, maybe on the peer regulation as it goes through all the different procedures. But I'm sure we'll touch on also the competition aspects when the EU competition authorities start focusing on maybe a company and its alleged anti-competitive behavior in some occasions. So let's start, first of all, it's not so much making a value judgment, because maybe not your role nor my role on the validity or the value of, if you like, of the EU's strategy on digital, but just about how they go about producing proposals, first of all. Let's start at the beginning. What are your views about how, especially the current commission, which is now ending its five-year tenure, has gone about producing proposals, consulting, getting internal buy-in, and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I was very fortunate to arrive in Brussels right at the beginning of these two very important pieces of legislation, which are the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act.
Right.
So if we step back even before the process starts, what is the ambition?
Right.
And the ambition is very simple. So we all use the internet and they want to make it safer and fairer. Safer for you and I as the users of TikTok and social media, and fairer for the competitors of Apple, Google, Meta. That, in a nutshell, that's what this commission has tried to do.
Right.
And you're asking me about the process and how it goes about it.
Yeah.
And like with everything in life, you have to bring in the stakeholders to the table, because if you isolated in your own ivory tower that we are overlooking here, the beautiful Berlaymont,
yeah,
just think big thoughts and just tell people that this is what you're doing before bringing everyone in, it's really just going to not fly.
Right.
And so the way I observe that they start doing that is, first of all, they start by commissioning reports from experts, you know, identifying what the big issues are, what the big problems are for this particular tech sector,
right,
before they even come out with draft proposals about what they want to do. I mean, I'm not going to go into detail on every step by step, but in essence, you identify the problem, you talk to all the major competitors of big tech, you bring in journalists, you talk about the ambition of this regulation, you release drafts so
right,
that people start, you know, strategically. I think people think that all these leaks from the commission are sort of like accidents that happened, that some, you know, bureaucrat just accidentally left it on the metro. But I think they are concerted efforts, exactly, precisely for the point of generating debate and involving society.
When you say generating the base, involving society, in the past the commission, even now, has been accused of basically already having made its mind up. And it seemed to get up to a point, critics say, just goes through the motions of consulting, you know, doing impact assessments, you know, cost-benefit analyses, if you like, putting out consultations. But they already have a pretty clear idea what they want, but they just want to be able to demonstrate that they've actually asked other people's opinion. Is there any validity in that criticism?
I mean, you could argue that it's very true. In fact, in impact assessments, my colleagues have written about the fact that they don't even do them anymore. So
right,
we're not even pretending that. But to the very narrowly defined thing of the DMA, Digital Markets Act, and the DSA, I think that there truly has been some debate.
Maybe, since you mentioned a couple of times now, some of our listeners who don't live and breathe this stuff like you do, quickly, if you wouldn't mind, do us a tutorial on what the DMA is and what the DSA is.
Yeah,
please.
As I said, you know, keeping the internet safe,
right,
and
okay,
keeping it fair. So the Digital Services Act, it's about telling big tech how they should police the internet, bring things down that are illegal or harmful to society, or tackle, right now we're heading towards the election, so Russian campaigns on disinformation or misinformation.
And that's the Digital Services Act.
Yeah, which it's quite surprising, because we have been living in an online world now for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And yet we didn't have up until very recently fully fledged, fully operational rules.
Right.
Everything was done by big tech on a voluntary basis, which is very crazy to think about that. You know, like, as I said, the level of ambition, critics might say it's very low, but necessary that we didn't even have rules to, you know, tell big tech how to police the internet. Right. And the second leg is the Digital Markets Act. As I said, I have seen rivals of Google and Meta and Apple heavily involved in deep discussions with the EU about what these rules should look like. And in essence, what the DMA aims to do is to lay the ground or open the ground so that those that are not the incumbents, the massive big players that can dictate the rules and own the platforms, allow them some breathing space so that they can prosper. And one day, Europe will have its own Google.
Right.
Which, you know, it's a bigger ambition.
Another aspiration. Yes. For the moment, an aspiration.
Yeah.
Let's deal quickly and up front with this, hardly a secret in Brussels, at least, which is the two main commissioners dealing with this broad agenda, as you know better than I do, are Margrethe Vestager, competition policy commissioner, vice president of the commission, and Thierry Breton, who has three directorates generals reporting to him, but he also has a very strong hand in all this. As I say, it's no secret that the two don't seem to get on very well. How does that, from your perspective as a senior media guy in Brussels, how does that manifest itself, this lack of entente between the two players?
I think there's no secret that there has been a growing animosity, let's say, between these two personalities. You know, I have the privilege to have access to people, you know, behind the curtains. And I guess at the beginning of this commission, even behind the curtains, the narrative was that everything was going fine. But increasingly we see, I mean, you just go and watch the press conferences and you can see the body language is indicative of
when
the
they
tensions.
Have to share a podium, you mean?
A podium, exactly. Right. But beyond the personalities, even though they're broadly from the same political group, you know, we have a small member state, a big influential member state on the other hand, which is all about industrial policy. So there is, beyond the sort of personality clashes, we do have a bigger debate, which is, you know, industrial policy. Should Europe allow, and this is a debate that is increasingly coming now with this competitiveness.
Right.
Should Europeans allow for these big European champions?
Right.
Or should we keep the competition sort of more fragmented and at national level, the big industrial debate?
Are you saying that this is a bit of a soap opera and that when push comes to shove, at the end of the day, the two sides kind of come together, they have a shared vision, as does Ursula von der Leyen, about where the EU should be going?
And it's been galvanized and very clearly articulated when it comes to this big fight, which I have been chronicling over the last 5 years, which is Brussels versus big tech.
Right.
And here, the alignment is, you know, laser focus, because the enemy is very clear, let's say.
Okay. Yeah. On that one, you touched on it briefly at the beginning, the communication. So upstream, we put to one side the extent to which the commission in particular consults other stakeholders, but then a proposal comes out, then it's up to the commission. You mentioned the press conferences, has to go out and promote these proposals and defend them, obviously, in the Council of the Parliament, but also using you guys in the press corps to promulgate their views. How good a communications operation does the Commission have in this tech sector?
Yeah. Are you implying that the media is merely a tool for regulators? Yes, I think what I've noticed in my interactions with the Commission is that they are very, very keen to show why they are here. To justify their existence. And I think we're not going to talk about Brexit, but just to say that after a breakaway of one of its member states, I think, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, but the feeling of the EU sort of justifying its
itself,
existence,
absolutely.
and why it's here, I have experienced it and lived it through the regulating of big tech, because I think it comes with big intentions, because the people behind, you know, with holding the pen,
on these regulations. I think they do have high ideals. I just don't think that they are just, or maybe I've drank the Kool-Aid, but I just don't think that they're just there just to regulate for the sake of it. They do want to, for instance, very concretely, when it comes to Apple and its ecosystem that it's created and dominated, they do want to allow for competing app stores to be on your phone. So it's not just one company controlling everything, with the view that this, as a consumer, you will be better off, goes the theory, because you will have more choice.
Right.
Of course, Apple might say you are disrupting a highly secure, really great user experience by opening up these systems, and you know, you're downgrading the experience of users.
You talked about this laser focus now that the commission has on regulating big tech. Was there some kind of tipping point when the commission decided we must, you know, almost change gear and get much more into this regulatory sphere, or was it an incremental thing? I mean, what triggered this focus, this huge focus now on regulating tech?
I think it was first incremental and then accelerated.
Right.
Incremental in that the Juncker Commission, which I did not cover, I understand had some ideas of digital, but this
5 years before the current commission.
5 years before the current commission, and this one in particular really went line by line. It did a sort of like a list of all the sins of how big tech is cornering markets and destroying competition in their eyes.
Yeah.
And it tackled every single behavior, and it put it into law as banned. I think that's quite significant.
Yeah.
The only problem with that, that people that I speak to tell me, is that we are looking at the past, and we are looking at, in particular, technology evolved very quickly overnight. Yeah. And so
decision making is rather slow.
And basically they are tackling things of the past that, you know, in 5 years might be irrelevant. We only saw ChatGPT. It's only about 15 months old, OpenAI.
Yeah.
And now it's become part of our psyche discourse. I, you know, rarely Google things now. I just put them in ChatGPT. I don't think we've invented a verb yet, but, you know, I'm sure it will come. So just to make the point that things are evolving very quickly. And in fact, if you look at artificial intelligence, which is one of the landmark pieces of legislation here as well that we haven't really discussed yet, the incumbents already are cornering the market. Microsoft, Google, they already have massive partnerships with what looks like the winners of this AI race so far.
Right. When proposals then come out into the public domain, and then the institutions get involved, as you know as well as I do, the Parliament is a relatively open institution, its committees are public, anybody can attend them, and there are the plenary sessions. Whereas the council and the working groups comprising national civil servants are not. It's the opposite. They're behind closed doors. Is there a danger for somebody like you in the press corps or the media more broadly to report on stuff which is easy to report on, stuff which is visible, as opposed to the detriment of stuff which is less visible, like these council working groups?
And I think there is quite a correlation between how opaque conversations are and where the power lies. And as you rightly point out, a discussion in the parliament, in a committee, has less relevance than when actually member states sit down and, you know, France and Germany say, okay, we're going to go ahead and push ahead. It is true. And this is, I guess, where the value of someone like me and my colleagues comes, which is, you know, to build relationships and sourcing with the people who are in the room.
Yeah.
What I think has been unfortunate in this last five-year period, and unfortunate to public discourse and democracy, but very fortunate to the people who were regulated, and they tell me when I meet them, is that there was little scrutiny over the legislation on digital, on AI. I remember when the AI Act drafts landed, it was some sort of esoteric, obscure thing. It wasn't really in people's sort of mind. But COVID accelerated and really made us aware of how reliant we were on digital. But then the war and the energy crisis and inflation, all this took away really the focus on all the legislative sausage-making process on digital.
Right.
It left not only
because you're talking about this sort of opaqueness and, you know, how very little access we have, that overlaid by the fact that media organizations maybe were more focused on bigger problems like energy crisis, inflation, the war. It made it much easier for legislators to legislate in the way they wanted because the focus was not there.
Interesting. Let's move on then to the lobbies, you know, whether they're corporations themselves, their trade associations, the consulting or law firms they hire to do work for them as well. From we'll talk in a second about how they come to you and try and use you as a tool, to use that word again, Javier, but also more seriously, from your perspective, when you observe these lobbies, it's difficult to move in Brussels without tripping over one of these people, obviously, because it's a huge part of the EU agenda, as you say. So what is your analysis of how effective these lobbies are and how they go about their business?
Yes, as you say, you can find a lobbyist in every corner of every street in Brussels. I think that on the one hand, obviously, they are limited to what they can do because once they're trying to influence something, it's a proposal from the European Commission. So it's a text. In a way, the EU has the first mover advantage. I mean, and it doesn't because, you know, some critics would say what the EU is doing now, they should have done a decade ago. So, you know, it's debatable. But in the narrowly defined sense of having a text and a proposal, already the EU has its first mover advantage. Yeah. They do have a lot of influence and access, as they rightly should, because if you're regulating a sector, you should have the right
to respond
to how, you know, these rules are going to be implemented. And in fact, I have this article here that we wrote recently on whether big tech will agree to play by Europe's rules. And it's all fine to see the lobbying and the influence on the text before it arrives, but once it's law, even then, companies, not through the lobbying, but through the way that they say that they are complying with the rules, have a lot of say. So they do have a lot of on-the-ground power, even beyond tech lobbying. In terms of lobbying itself, I am, of course, under no illusion that when I'm speaking to a big tech company, they have an agenda. Mm. In fact, during these 5 years, I was fortunate enough to go to Silicon Valley for a few weeks in between my stint in Brussels, and that was very refreshing because here the narrative is, please regulate us. But of course, how do we regulate the way we want you to regulate us? Yeah. Please regulate us this way. But in San Francisco, where the innovation is happening and where they're far away from this town, regulation is not even part of the mindset, you know?
Yeah.
The DNA, and I guess that's why these tech companies are very successful, is to move fast and break things.
But I'm intrigued by the process still, because we just touched on how upstream the commission makes certain efforts to consult, to do assessments and ask people what they think before a proposal becomes public. Then it's public, it goes into the public debate in the European Parliament, the much more opaque debate, as you touched on, in the council working groups. And then you have this strange thing called a trilogue, when all these institutions come together and thrash out some kind of some text they can agree on, again, behind closed doors. And we see maybe an extreme version of that in the last few weeks, because it's the end of this legislative cycle, and there's been almost like a self-imposed pressure to get things done before certain deadlines, at the cost of maybe consistency, coherence, and quality of rulemaking. Am I overstating that?
I don't think you're overstating it. I think we, as we said earlier, there is this need by not just the European Commission, but by the Parliament, by the Member States, to show sort of hyperactivity in the sense that, you know, I'm always amazed that we live in a city that, you know, moves slowly and it's quite inefficient on so many levels, but we can have a separate podcast on that. And yet we are forever surprised by announcements, moves, even when, you know, in financial services, which I don't cover on a daily basis, but even then, we have a revision of one law after the other. This place is in sort of hyper activity mode. So I don't think you're overstating it.
And is it, as the Commission or the EU more broadly almost got drunk on this idea of being the regulator of the world, of the famous Brussels effect people talk about, coined by the academic Andrew Bradford, almost the point of where it's almost got ahead of itself or even become too successful in the sense that other regulatory regimes across the world are saying, well, why should we be obliged to, you know, this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that Brussels regulates and all, and the rest of us have to follow suit. Where's all this going?
Industrialists that I talked to, we had recently an interview with the CEO of Ericsson and others, they're calling for a pause on, right, on regulation, to which I immediately say, you know, what's the incentive of a regulator but to regulate? Yeah. So I think good luck to these calls of asking people here in Brussels to come in a new commission and just implement. Imagine how dull the life of a EU official would be if you're only inheriting something that your predecessors did just to make sure that the wheels are turning on that. So I think that we are only seeing, or I have seen, an acceleration, a speeding up of new rules coming through all the time. In fact, after, I'm pretty certain, the next commission, we're going to see a revision of these rules because people will find that, yeah, you know, these rules need to be tweaked or they need to be improved. So you should expect Brussels to continuously regulate. On the front as to where we're going with that, say, for example, if we take AI, which is a very important, a subject that concerns people, people have realized what the actual use of AI is in their daily lives. Brussels did move first with the rules.
Right.
But you see, you know, mushrooming of different G7 initiatives, OECD, okay, United Nations. Everyone wants to have a say. So I don't think, even though we still have the Brussels effect because, as I said, they're the first movers when it comes to regulation. I think other blocks, other groups of power or organizations are also not just letting Brussels take all the credit.
Yeah. Maybe a last point then. Could you touch on something which I find very intriguing? There's quite a common view now as we approach the last 6 months of the current van der Leyen Commission that this high level of activity, some would say hyperactivity, especially in the tech sector and the regulatory environment surrounding it. But the next commission, whoever ends up being the president, doesn't really matter, I suppose, will be much more focused on, or needs to be much more focused on, implementation and enforcement, which kind of suggests, you know, very very simplistic terms, that they stop regulating and they focus on making sure what has been finally adopted by everybody is actually, you know, working and implemented. Maybe you're touching on something somewhere in the middle, that there will be this focus on enforcement and implementation, but it will involve also going back to some of the texts. It's not just saying, here, we approve this, you guys make sure at the national level, member state level, you make sure you comply because we agreed it. You're suggesting maybe there'll be some kind of halfway house where we will go, not back to the drawing board, that suggests a kind of wholesale revision, but there'll be, under the very justified, I suppose, view that we need to improve the quality of the text, there'll be quite a lot of activity, which is a new regulatory agenda almost.
Yes, and if you think about it, I'm just trying to think back on this term that has emerged now, competitiveness. I think, yeah, actions will gravitate or go around this idea of competitiveness. How do we make Euro competitive? On the point on big tech, we just really need to step back. And if you think, okay, we talk about trialogues and DMA, DSA, what is the big picture? What is it that the European Union is trying to achieve? They, yeah, want to allow new Meta, Apple, the successful, huge, some of the largest companies ever created in the history of humankind,
yeah,
to also emerge here. Some up to now, I'm unconvinced. I think that Europe has continued to be really good at regulating, but I haven't seen an amazing example. I mean, maybe you have Spotify, the Swedish, yeah, music streaming app, but we would struggle to come up with a handful of examples. So on that metric, Europe, I think, has lost this round, at least, of the tech wars.
Okay. Right. Well, there's still so much to talk about. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Javier Espinoza, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.